ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The mainstream high school model never gelled with me, that environment. I was never really comfortable in. Very hard to get through high school when you can't really relate to people and you don't really have a friend group, so it becomes just a negative experience for me.
What does it take to engage the kids who, for many reasons, have failed to find their place in the mainstream school system? Shortly, we'll head to one school that may have the answer.
When there's been disruptions to learning or disruptions to childhood and trauma, that punitive model just as two bulls in the paddock banging heads together.
And sea urchins may not be on the menu for many Australians, but this expensive seafood delicacy is proving to be a golden export opportunity that's good for business and the environment.
The expansion of this fishery and the ability to export their product is really important, not only for our rural and regional economies, but there is real potential for that fishery to help control overabundant urchin populations.
I'm Alex Simon and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country, Perth. But firstly, Bankwest has announced today that it will be closing all of its remaining 45 branches by October of this year as it transitions to being a digital-only bank. The move to digital-only banking and subsequent closure of bricks-and-mortar branches has been the key concern raised during the ongoing Regional Banking Senate inquiry that's examining close to 2,000 regional bank closures in the past 6 years. Today's announcement from Bankwest will see 17 regional bank branches permanently closed, with a further 15 regional locations converting to Commonwealth Bank branches by the end of the year. In a statement, Bankwest says the decision for the digital transition is influenced by rapidly changing customer preferences, with 97% of all Bankwest transactions now completed digitally and fewer than 2% of customers visiting a branch regularly. The bank says its metro branches average around 30 over-the-counter transactions per day, with regional branches averaging around 15 over-the-counter transactions per day.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
A new project in Victoria's Latrobe Valley could soon see one person's trash become another's treasure, quite literally. The state's first ever waste-to-energy project has just been given the green light, which would transform Melbourne's curbside collections into a somewhat useful commodity. Our reporter in Gippsland, Jared Whittaker, has been covering this issue. Jared, in a nutshell, how does this work? How can household rubbish be transformed into energy?
What happens with waste-to-energy projects is that companies that are doing them sign contracts with, you know, commercial providers that, you know, have a lot of waste, or local councils, and they get that and they collect it and they take it to a site where it will be fed into a bunker in what's supposed to be an enclosed area. And from there, it goes into a furnace where it's burnt and used to create electricity. So when it's burnt, heat's created, it can turns water into steam, and that steam drives a generator to provide electricity. And in this case, where this project's being introduced at a paper mill, they're going to harness the steam energy as well.
And what kind of rubbish do they use?
Oh, look, this is your typical household waste. So it could be the nappies that you've thrown out if you've got kids. It could be some of the plastics that aren't suitable for recycling, bits of metal and things that end up, even, you know, the dog poo that you throw away, if that's what you do, could end up being burnt and then you're being used to create electricity.
And how does the community feel about this?
There's obviously a range of different opinions to this. So where this is being done in Victoria's Latrobe Valley, so a couple of hours east of Melbourne, it's a region with a strong history in the production of electricity from coal and also in manufacturing. So those are industries that are undergoing massive change in terms of jobs being lost. So for people who want to see security of employment in their region, news like this, which means that a local employer, a major local employer, is able to continue to operate in the region and get its costs down is good news, because it means that, you know, that those jobs are likely to stay for the long term. Now, that's not the universal view. There are environmental groups in the region which fear that, you know, that there's not enough regulation or restriction on this. So the local Friends of the Local Waterways group is concerned that, you know, that toxins and contaminants could, you know, inadvertently be discharged from the plant and get into the local atmosphere. So in the Latrobe Valley in 2014, there was a big mine fire when a bushfire got into a coal mine that blanketed the region in really toxic smoke for 40 days, led to an increase in deaths. So there are people who are, you know, very sensitive to anything which could have a further detrimental event to local air quality.
Let's hear from Tracy Anton, who is with the environmental group you've just mentioned there, Friends of Latrobe Water.
There's been a lot of concern worldwide about waste to energy. Primarily, a lot of people have been concerned about their CO2 emissions for the global effect. But locally, there's also toxic emissions. And that's our biggest concern, that why is Latrobe Valley always the industrial area where the community, you know, get the impacts from bad air pollution?
Tracy Anton from Friends of Latrobe Water speaking there. And further to that, Jared, are there concerns around carbon emissions from incinerating the waste? Will the benefits outweigh the costs when it comes to climate impact?
So Opal, who's installing this in their plant, believe that overall that this will be a net environmental gain. They're saying that 270,000 tonnes of greenhouse gas emissions will be taken out of the atmosphere each year, which they say equates to taking 50,000 cars off the road.
Here's what Opal's General Manager of Corporate Development, David Gentner, had to say on that point.
When we talk about the CO2, when you combust waste, you will generate CO2. We don't have, at this point in time, CO2 carbon capture technology on the facility. So the CO2 that comes from the process itself will be emitted. But what we need to understand is when waste goes to landfill, any organics in the waste rot and produce methane. And that methane is much more harmful to climate change, a bigger contributor to climate change than just straight CO2. It's about a factor of 26 times.
Opal's David Gentner speaking there. Jared, now that the project's been green lit, what happens next?
So there's still a construction process which has to go on from here. We're not quite sure exactly what the timelines for that are, because this project's been in the pipelines for about 5 years. And in that time, they've been doing planning, striking deals with different councils, commercial operators who have large amounts of rubbish. So they need to get all that done. I believe most of that work is done. And from here, they need to start moving into the construction phase. So we're not quite sure what the timeline is yet. This is obviously the first of these projects to get approval under new Environment Protection Authority guidelines in Victoria. But I don't know if this will end up being Australia's first waste-to-energy project that actually starts operation.
The energy generated at this plant will be used to power Opal Australia's Maryvale paper mill in the Latrobe Valley there. But just this morning, Opal has announced some big job cuts. What's the latest here?
Opal has told its workforce that it's going to cut 220 jobs across its Australian and New Zealand operations. So they've got the paper operator in our region in the Latrobe Valley. They've got a plant in Preston in the northern suburbs of Melbourne where they produce stationery, and another site in Sydney. We understand that it's about 40 to 45 jobs which are going locally, but that comes off the back of Opal's decision to stop producing white paper at the Maryvale paper mill in December 2022, which resulted in the loss of another 200 jobs. So this is a business which has always been a bit precarious economically and has always been looking at ways to save money. A few years ago, its maintenance workers at Opal agreed to take a pay cut just so they could help improve its bottom line.
Will these job cuts affect the plan for construction of this plant at the paper mill?
It doesn't look like that the loss of these jobs, 220 across the business, at the entire business, and 45 at the Maryvale paper mill, will affect this project. I think this is a way of the company cutting costs at the plant, which has, you know, traditionally struggled a bit in terms of being able to be profitable. And I think that these job cuts are all about improving the profitability of the company. So at this stage, it looks like this project is set to go ahead, even if a few other jobs are lost along the way.
Jared Whittaker is our reporter there in Gippsland. Jared, thanks again for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
ABC Australia Wide.
Let's head to Ballarat now. What does it take to engage the kids who, for many reasons, have disengaged from the mainstream education system? Well, a school in regional Victoria thinks it's found a way. Rhiannon Stevens has this story.
When Thomas started high school in 2020, he found the transition from primary school a challenge.
You know, large groups of people and
different age groups, and you know, it's very hard to get through high school when you can't really relate to people and you don't really have a friend group, so it becomes just a negative experience for me.
Now aged 17, Thomas has missed long periods of his education after he stopped going to school.
The mainstream high school model never gelled with me, that environment I was never really comfortable in.
This year, Thomas is giving school another go at St Joseph's in Ballarat. The school is run by Catholic organisation Edmund Rice Education and says it aims to support students disengaged from education through a more flexible approach.
When kids are acting up, you know, the teachers aren't going off at them like you'd see at a normal high school. It's a different kind of vibe, which I like.
Thomas says the biggest difference is the emphasis the school places on mental well-being.
We always have just how you're going at the start of the day, and I think at normal high schools you kind of have to seek that out and get that arranged, but here it's just second nature.
Principal Troy Strybosch says at St Joseph's the class sizes are small, there are youth workers as well as teachers, and staff receive training in trauma-informed practice.
Finding common ground with a young person who's had disruptions is far more effective than the punitive model that's been traditional. When there's been disruptions to learning or disruptions to childhood and trauma, that punitive model just is two bulls in the paddock banging heads together.
The school has no uniform, no fees, and provides meals in an attempt to break down the barriers stopping students from attending school. Troy says the more informal approach can help the growing number of young people disengaging from education.
So COVID disrupting education has become a major theme. Obviously, you know, modern society, substance abuse and then behavioural problems, and some of those will stem from COVID. There will be learning issues. There will be conditions and things that are really difficult to cater with mainstream schooling.
Despite St Joseph's Ballarat only opening several weeks ago, its 120 places are already full. And while the school is new, the model isn't. Other St Joseph's campuses have existed for more than a decade. Ex-student Joey Edoetta attended the school's Melbourne campus. He later returned to the school as a youth worker, helping teachers in the classroom.
There's so many good teachers, but I guess if you're just going in there by yourself, it would be super stressful for the teacher, I would say. Like, the young people go through some of the worst traumas that you could ever think of, that sort of stuff. And, yeah, if you didn't have a youth worker and only a teacher to manage that, wouldn't be the best.
Joey says schools like St Joseph's are a place of last resort when kids aren't welcome in the mainstream education system.
I feel like schools don't want them.
Yep.
So they do whatever they can to not get the young people back. It's just a bit off-putting as a human being as well. Like, schools are meant to be here for these kids in the area or whatever, and they kind of, yeah, just put in the too hard basket, I would say, and kind of just push to the side.
Joey has gone from a young man expelled from high school in year 8 to now studying a master's by research of education. He says his journey wouldn't have been possible without St Joseph's. For Troy, providing support is the school's number one goal.
That's probably a really important part of what we do is have good, strong relationships. And when our young people are expressing, you know, dysregulation that because of things that have happened to them in the outside environment, we're ready to be a supportive community. And as you can see, as they come past the window, that's that sense of, oh, that's the principal and we're allowed to pull funny faces and see if we can put him off talking into a microphone. That sense of fun, I'm really okay with, and I think that's a really good thing to happen.
That's Troy Strybosch, principal at St Joseph's School in Ballarat, ending that report by Rhiannon Stevens. If you've ever tried to start a business, then you'd know that it involves a lot more than just having an idea. And say it's a landscape business. Actually, being a good landscaper is only part of the job. There's so much more to do on the business and admin side. No matter how good your idea is, if you don't have anyone to help guide you, your dream might remain just that, a dream. However, a new initiative by the New South Wales State Government is trying to bring some of these dreams to life by raising up the next generation of entrepreneurs equipped with tax knowledge, business skills, and the drive to change the world. From regional New South Wales, reporter James Tugwell has this story.
When Walbunja man Jordan Nye was inspired to start his own business, he had an exciting idea, but no one to turn to for help. as he looked around his family and community in his hometown of Mogo on the New South Wales far south coast, he didn't know anyone who had walked that path before him.
For me, it was a big challenge to find people within my family and community to support me starting my own business and becoming an entrepreneur. There wasn't many people around me that owned business or could show or teach me how to run a business.
He launched his business, Mullah de Gumra, 2 years ago, capitalising on growing interest in cultural tourism by employing local Indigenous people to run cultural youth programs, immersion experiences, traditional dance and ceremony, and cultural consultancy services.
So really just providing that safe space for people to come and learn culture, but also tackling drugs and alcohol and mental health by providing mob with a space to learn about their cultural identity and give them a purpose other than the usual cycles that we see within our families. And, you know, it was a big challenge to be able to get that started because it was new. There's not really much like this or this type of business out there.
It changed Jordan's life.
To be able to run my own business and my own company has really made a big impact on my life, but not only just my life, my family's life.
Now, Mr. Nye is helping the next generation of Indigenous students dream big for the future. He's co-facilitating the Invest in Yourself, Exploring Money and Self-Employment workshops as a part of the New South Wales Government's Regional Aboriginal Partnerships Program, in conjunction with the Sydney School of Entrepreneurship. Mr. Nye ran the workshop in Batemans Bay, the fifth of eight workshops across the state, with others in Bathurst, Dubbo, Kempsey, Manila, Cardiff, Tumut and Warragee. The workshops are designed to equip local Indigenous high school students with money management skills and the ability and confidence to launch their own business.
So to be able to have a program like this when I was young would have been massive, you know, not only just for myself, but my peers and my friends and family that of my age at that time.
Batemans Bay High School Year 10 student Emma Sprouts says the workshops equipped her with business skills such as managing money and tax.
Made me believe that I can start a business, and that's not that hard, because before this program I did think it was like starting a business would be like really hard, but I don't think it would be.
She currently works with Mr. Nye at Mullah de Gumra and dreams of taking over the business in the future. However, at the workshops, she was brainstorming ideas for a business running racism education programs in schools.
There's a lot of racism in my community and I want to change that, like educate more people about my culture and where everyone is standing on this land.
Sydney School of Entrepreneurship training facilitator Frank Newman was responsible for running the workshops and transforming lessons about business into fun, engaging and inspiring sessions. Mr. Newman says the program is all about helping students identify problems in their own community and think of creative ways to address those problems.
We've really looked at problems in the community as perceived by those young people and then started to craft a business idea as the solution to that problem. So rather than just kind of thinking about things as a side hustle, we've actually gone, well, what are the problems? You know, really, what are they? And we dug into those and we had, as strange as it may sound, joyful conversations about kind of big, deep and meaningful and sometimes, you know, difficult conversations like housing and poverty and drugs and mental health. And through those conversations, we've now started to look at how we might set up businesses which could be profitable, you know, or money-making businesses which look at solving some of those issues. And so it comes down to those young people thinking creatively and innovatively and, being the leaders of the future. It's a great privilege to be in the room with these young people. I feel that it's... watching them go through the process and knowing that they have ideas which could change people's lives and change their own lives in so doing is really it's exciting. I find it incredibly motivating and it makes me feel like the future is full of hope.
Frank Newman from the Sydney School of Entrepreneurship talking with our reporter James Tugwell on the south coast of New South Wales. And finally, here on Australia Wide, let's head to the far south coast of New South Wales, where sea urchins aren't just a marine pest, but a viable industry. Two factories on that stretch of coastline have just become the first and only licensees in the state to export their product to Asia. Marine biologists are hailing the expansion as good news for marine environments, which are under threat from the overabundant sea urchins. And for one family business, the prospect of exporting was only possible thanks to some enthusiastic international workers. From the far south coast of New South Wales, our reporter Bernadette Clark has this story.
New South Wales has reached a major milestone in exporting sea urchin roe overseas. There are just three factories in the country that are licensed to do so, the third situated in Tasmania. After trialling some shipments at the end of last year, Sea Urchin Harvest in Maroochydore and South Coast Sea Urchins in Murrimbula now officially export to countries including Korea and China.
That's as good as it gets.
Director and owner of family-run Sea Urchin Harvest, Chris Theodore, says the journey hasn't been easy.
It's great. It's challenging as well. You've got to have A-grade, really high-quality product for the Asian market, and there's a lot of competition worldwide with sea urchins. But, we're just sort of starting to send some now, and it's going quite well.
Without help from international workers, Sea Urchin Harvest says they might have struggled to get their produce out of the door, in a plane, and onto a plate of a high-end restaurant overseas. The addition of 30 international workers at the factory in Maroochydore have helped them double their tonnage from 2 to 4 in the last 6 months. While eating sea urchin roe might not sound appealing to some, it is a delicacy for international workers like Li Lim from Malaysia and Phoebe Chen from Taiwan. One teaspoon of roe can cost up to $40 in a Melbourne restaurant. The pair were intrigued by the prospect of working with seafood rather than on a traditional farm to complete their 88 days on their working holiday visa. Li Lim from Malaysia says she's loved regional life on the New South Wales south coast.
It's fun here because I met a lot of people and, of course, other backpacker, Taiwanese, like a lot of other national people. At the same time, the locals are nice to us, and we learn a lot of Aussie accents that we never heard of it. Most of the day is like my holiday after work, because everyone is having their holiday. You can't really see busy people here, because there is no like 9 to 5 office hour. No, so people surround you with holiday mood. That's why they are nice.
She joked that her friends from home can see why she wanted to work in the factory.
Asian eat this thing. So we are quite fancy of this thing. Like, while you're working in a sea urchin, it's very expensive things. I'm glad that you work here so that you can get free urchin. One fun thing happened in the sea urchin where James mentioned no workers. Then we was like, there's a workers here. Everyone here are workers. Why are you saying no workers? So basically he's saying no workers, it's like no worries.
Oh, then we're no like, workers.
Oh, it's like, oh, it's no worries.
Do you say it now?
Not really, because to me it's like a bit different.
Meanwhile, Phoebe Chen from Taiwan says she's enjoyed meeting different people.
I think it's good because we can do the cultural exchange and language exchange. We can discuss a lot of like culture different or culture shock. It's pretty fun.
Ms. Chen said it's been a special experience.
It's cool to see how like they deal with the sea urchin, like opening and pick up the organ or something. Yeah, and packaging. It's pretty good. I would say compared to the fruit picking, inside is more comfortable than the outside, the sun or it's raining.
And marine scientists are happy too. Dr. Kane Layton from the University of Tasmania says the expansion of New South Wales sea urchin businesses is a win for Australia's east coast.
The expansion of this fishery and the ability to export their product is really important, not only for our rural and regional economies, but there is real potential for that fishery to help control overabundant urchin populations. So when urchins become really overabundant in the environment, they do overgraze our kelp forests, and they basically create this, what we call an urchin barren.
With a greater capacity for businesses to expand with international export licences, then more sea urchins will be able to be harvested. Despite being native to New South Wales, long-spined sea urchins have degraded reefs and are destroying healthy marine habitats.
they overgraze large areas of kelp forest and they create what's called an urchin barren. And that's an area of degraded reef that doesn't support the same amount of biodiversity or productivity that a healthy kelp forest does. As long as this resource can be harvested sustainably, I mean, it creates really new, exciting economic opportunities and environmental opportunities for this part of the world.
The industry could be set to grow with two more sea urchin factories in New South Wales waiting for export approval.
And thanks to our reporter Bernadette Clark for that story from Maruya in New South Wales. And that is Australia Wide for this Wednesday. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Hope you can join me then. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.